his door handle, he said. Maybe somebody wiped him off, or maybe his body was dragged over the handle. I tweezed up some broken glass from the ground and inside the truck. The lab found Dave's prints on a couple of them. I know there's an explanation. I just need to get the explanation into my paperwork. He looked down as he pulled his tie taut on his shirt front and at the same time took her measure from her breasts to her thighs. "What's your name again?" she asked.
"Call me Spade."
"You're giving me information civilians aren't supposed to have."
"I'm trying to be subtle here. I didn't want this investigation, or at least not one that would cause a colleague problems. Tell Dave I think he was probably out at the D'Artes place to talk about the accident, and he had occasion to put his hands on the driver's window of the pickup."
"How long have you been doing homicide investigations?"
"It's not my area. I worked vice and narcotics at Miami-Dade. I was undercover in Liberty City."
"Liberty City is all black."
"I figured that out when they started throwing spears at me from the fire escapes."
There was a beat.
"Oops. My bad."
"Come back later, okay?" she said.
"If you work the inner city, you have to develop a sense of humor. Ask Purcell. I heard he had a way of dipping into the culture. What a character."
He lit a cigarette with a gold lighter, the smoke rising out of his cupped hand. "Could you not do that, please?"
"You don't let people smoke on your property?" he said.
She tried to crinkle her eyes, but couldn't. There was a bilious taste in her mouth that made her want to spit. He flipped his cigarette, sparking into a camellia bush, and rotated his head as though he had a stiff neck.
"It's good you're rigging up old leaves," he said. "When they get into the bayou, the biodegradation uses up the oxygen and kills the fish."
"Yep, that's what it does," she said. She propped the rake on the ground, her left hand on the shaft. She saw him use the opportunity to glance at her ring finger.
"There's a lot of this area I still haven't seen," he said. "One day I'd like somebody to show me around. I could do the same for them in New Orleans. Show them all the things nobody knows about, including where all the skeletons are hid. In the old days, the mob dumped jack rollers in Lake Pontchartrain because they were bad for tourism. Cops would throw them out of a car at high speed by the Huey Long Bridge. They got things done back then. That was before your time."
"I don't think you're looking for exculpatory evidence about Dave," she said. "I don't think you're a friend. I think you have a lean and hungry look."
"If there's something I haven't done to help your stepfather, tell me what it is, little lady, and I'll get on it."
"He's not my stepfather. He's my father. Call me little lady again and see what happens." He sucked in his breath, smiling wetly as though acknowledging his indiscretion. "I don't choose my words very well. That's probably why I've remained a single man."
"I'd better finish my work. I'll give Dave your message."
He snapped his fingers.
"Sorry, I forgot to ask you something."
She waited.
"Call it deep background," he said. "It doesn't have anything to do with the case itself. How many times did Dave have to bust the cap on a guy or break his spokes, particularly in a close-quarter situation? Like when he was arresting a guy, or the guy got in his face and he lost it. I never met an old-school cop yet who took shit off mutts and perps. Can you give me a ballpark number?"
Chapter 10 In the life, Cleet was known as Conwise, even though he had never been a convict. The term in the criminal subculture is laudatory and indicates a level of knowledge and experience that cannot be acquired in a library. You also have to pay dues. A solid or stand-up con stacks his own time. Does it straight up, without early release, work furloughs, conjugal privileges, or snitching off fellow inmates for favorable treatment. It's not easy. Ask anyone who stood on the oil barrel in Huntsville or chopped cotton inside the system in Arkansas or been thrown into a lockdown unit full of wolves. Cleet went his own way, didn't impose it on others, and asked the same respect. He would not only lay down his life for a friend, he would paint the walls with his friend's enemies. He grew up in the old Irish Channel and palled around with guys like Tony Cardo, who was probably the most intelligent and dangerous and successful old-school gangster New Orleans ever produced. When they were kids, Cleet and Tony found a box of human arms outside the incinerator by the Tulane Medical School and hung them from the straps of the St. Claude streetcar just as all the employees from the cigar factory were boarding. One passenger leaped from the window and crashed on top of a snowball cart. Except for Tony, Cleet's old-time buds went to the can or the chair, and Cleet went to Vietnam and came back with the Navy Cross, the Silver Star, and two hearts, and cruised right back into the Big Sleazy without giving any of it a second thought. I drove to his cottage at the motor court Thursday afternoon. He was standing amid the trees, grilling a 2-inch-thick steak, flipping it with a fork. He wore a Hawaiian shirt and a pork pie hat tilted on his brow and a pair of dark blue rayon workout pants that covered his shoelaces.
"Big Mun, I was just fixing to ask you and Al a fair over."
"How you doing?" I said.
"Not bad."
When Cleet was equivocal, you tended to glance at the sky for thunderclouds, dust rising out of the fields, a splinter of lightning on the horizon. "What's wrong?" I said.
"Have a seat."
I sat down at a picnic table made of green planks and covered with bird droppings and needles from a slash pine.
"I'm worried about Kevin Penny," he said. "I think he's got you on the brain."
"He's not coming after me, Cleet. If he does, we'll punch his ticket. He knows that."
"You don't get it. He's an obvious habitual, but he's not on parole, he has no outstanding warrants, and he doesn't have to register as a sex offender, even though he was up on sexual assault charges a couple of times. I don't know how he got out of Rayford, either. They should have welded the door on him and poured concrete on top of it."
"What was he in for?"
"Distribution of cocaine and assault with a deadly weapon, but they couldn't get him for the bigger charge. He and two other guys tortured a dealer in Little Havana for his stash. They hung him from a hoist on a wrecker and put a propane torch on him."
"You're saying Penny is protected?"
"He has to be. Pukes in the projects do life for 3 street busts involving amounts of money you could steal from bubblegum machines."
"Who's his protector?"
"I know you don't like this, but I think Jimmy Nightingale is a player in this."
"A player in what?"
"Setting you up."
"Maybe I wasn't set up. Maybe I killed T.J. D'Artes."
"This is what Penny just told me."
"Wait a minute. You just saw Penny?"
"This morning. I saw the social worker who'll be looking after his kid, too. I told Penny I'd be visiting him. Kind of like an old friend. Penny says Nightingale is a geek. He says he's AC/DC and humps his sister, or half-sister, or whatever she is."
"This guy has no credibility, Cleet."
"Penny says Nightingale is eaten up with guilt. Maybe he killed somebody."
I didn't reply.
"You don't buy it?"
"I don't know. Rowena Broussard says he raped her. He claims he never touched her. When I interviewed him, he almost had me convinced."
"Go on."
"I felt like he wanted to confess, but not to rape. Something else. Maybe Penny is right." He forked the steak off the flames and laid it on a plate.
"Is that what you came by to tell me?"
"No. I got the loan on my house. You're a quarter of a mil richer than you were this morning."
"You actually did that?"
"Why not?" His eyes were shiny. He wiped them on his forearm.
"I've got to get out of this smoke."
"Pay off those bums and get them out of your life."
"You're truly a nobleman, nobleman. I'll brown us some bread."
That evening, pushing a basket at Winn-Dixie, I saw a young woman with a small red mouth and amber-colored hair and a flush on her cheeks. "There you are again," she said. "Remember me?" I had to think. "You're Babette, from the bar and grill. You ordered 2 doubles and a Heineken. You was waiting for your friend, but you drank it all."
"I wish I hadn't."
"Your friend come in afterward. You're a friend of Mr. Spade, ain't you?" We were in the middle of the aisle, but no one else was around. "Spade LaBiche came in the bar after I left?"
"Yes, sir.
He left his gold lighter. I run out after him. He was talking to another man, but he drove off before I could catch him.
What'd you do with the lighter?
I put it in the drawer for a couple of days. When he didn't come in, I dropped it through the mail slot in the big building with a note.
Did Mr. Spade tell you he was looking for me?
He was in the corner. He come over and asked if you'd gone in the bathroom. I told him you was gone.
Do you know who Mr. Spade was with? Her eyes lingered on mine, as though she was standing on the edge of a cliff.
I seen him once before. I don't know his name or nothing about him.
What's he look like?
He's got bad skin. It's thick, like leather. Like his eyes are looking out of holes. I ain't caused no trouble, no.
Of course not. You're a nice person, Miss Babette. Did Mr. Spade thank you for returning his lighter?
No, sir, he ain't said nothing.
I took the business card out of my wallet and wrote my unlisted number on the back. If you see that other guy again, give me a ring. Or if you have any problems with anything at all, give me a ring. I could see the uncertainty, the fear about her job, her paycheck, her relationship with her boss, the prospect of offending people with power and authority over others. The dark figure sitting in the shadows at the end of the bar when it's closing time. I wondered how many people would understand her frame of reference. She squeezed the card in her fist.
I better go.
Remember what I said. You're a nice lady.
Thank you,
she replied. She pushed her basket to the cashier's counter and didn't look back. On Friday morning, I went into Labiche's office. It was hardly more than a cubicle located in a corner without windows. "What's the haps?" I said. He looked up from his paperwork. He tried to grin.
"What's shaking, Robo?"
"Alfair told me about your visit to my house. You found my prints on some broken glass."
"Like I told her. There's probably an explanation. Maybe you didn't have your latex on at the crime scene."
"No, my gloves weren't. Why didn't you come to my office instead of my house?"
"Because you weren't here."
His lighter was on the desk blotter. He picked it up and began clicking the top up and down.
"Nice lighter," I said.
"Real gold."
"A gift." "What do you want, Slick?"
"Slick?
Get off your high horse."
"I want you not snooping around my house. I want you not looking at my daughter in an inappropriate way."
"I tried to give you the benefit of the doubt, but that's a waste of time. For arrogance, you take the cake."
"I think you're a Judas and a liar."
"Do you know you smell like puke at a crime scene? You're a rummy, my friend. I don't know why Helen keeps you around."
I walked closer to his desk. I rested my fingertips on the edge, felt the grain of the wood. "Stay away from my daughter." He laughed under his breath. "You're amused," I said.
"Yeah, by you. I'll make sure I call you Dave from now on. See you later, Dave."
I went back to my office, leaving the ceiling lights off, and sat behind my desk and stared through the window, my breath coming hard in my throat, a sound like the ocean whirring in my ears. Then I went downstairs and printed out the rap sheet and mugshots of Kevin Penny on file at the National Crime Information Center. After the lunch crowd had left the bar and grill in the bayou, I parked an unmarked car under a shade tree on the street paralleling the bayou and entered the building through the kitchen. I saw Babette unloading dishes from a washer, her face bright with perspiration in the steam.
"Can I speak with you, Miss Babette?"
She wiped her nose with her wrist.
"I'm working, Mr. Dave.
It'll just take a minute."
She looked around, then followed me out on the deck. The tables were empty, the sky blue, the wind gusting along the bayou. A black kid was flying a yellow kite above the oaks in front of the old convent. I had the photos of Penny in a manila folder. I opened and flattened it on the deck rail.
"You know this guy?" She stared at Penny's face. Her eyes narrowed. I ain't sure.
It's important, Babette.
A lot of people come in here. At night they all look the same.
I'm not asking you to appear at a lineup or testify at a trial. This guy has nothing to do with your life. I just want to know if you've seen him.
I need this job, Mr. Dave. I got a little girl. I ain't got no husband.
This won't have any effect on your job. I give you my word.
Maybe he was the guy talking with Mr. Spade the night you was in.
Maybe?
Yes, sir,
she said, nodding. Take another look, Babette.
I don't need to.
That's the guy?
People look different in the daytime than they do at night. Has this guy done some bad things?
A few.
I don't want to lie to you, Mr. Dave. I just don't want to say no more. I don't never talk about people.
I closed the folder and put it under my arm. You don't need to say any more, Babette.
What if he comes back?
Don't worry about it.
That's it?
That's it. I patted her on the arm.
I'm all mixed up, she said. You're giving me your word, ain't you? Ain't nothing gonna happen?
You're not involved.
What do you call this?
She said. At 4:15 the same day, Jimmy Nightingale was in my office. The top of my desk was littered with photographs from a hit-and-run fatality on the four-lane south of town. There were bags under Jimmy's eyes, a funky smell in his clothes.
You gotta help me out, Dave.
I was about to have another lesson on the number of manifestations that can live in the people we think we know best.
Have a seat. Can you talk to my cousin Emmeline?
I heard she was your half-sister.
I'm not sure what she is. My father's penis roved over 5 continents. Tell her I didn't do it. You know me all my life. I don't rape women, for God's sake.
People do things when they're drunk that they would never do sober.
I wasn't that drunk.
You were drinking and took a married woman on your boat, in this case one who obviously had the hots for you. You think things wouldn't get out of hand in a scenario like that?
I know what I did and what I didn't do. She was plastered. She fell down outside the lounge. I had to pick her up and put her in the car. I didn't want to take her back to her car, nor did I want to dump her drunk at her house, so we drove down to Sippermore Point, and I showed her my boat and tried to get some coffee down her.
I thought about the bruise inside Rowena's thigh and the scratches on her hip and wondered if Jimmy was providing a fabricated explanation for them. I think you ought to get a lawyer, I said.
I have a half dozen of them. I don't want this going into a courtroom. I want to work it out.
By denying you didn't do anything wrong?
Right now, I just want you to talk to Emmeline.
Why?
Because you're a straight shooter.
Wish I could help you.
She and I are close.
I'm not sure I want to hear what you're telling me.
You're going to hear it whether you like it or not.
I shook my head. Nope, this has nothing to do with the issue. Talk to a minister or a therapist, Jimmy. This is the wrong place for it.
She was in an orphanage in Mexico City. You can imagine what kind of place it was. I'm the center of her life.
I got up from the desk and looked out the window, my back turned to him. I don't know how this one is going to play out, Jimmy.
Yeah, you do. I'm innocent. And you goddamn well know it.
But innocent of what? You say you didn't touch Rowena.
Maybe you guys got it on and she got caught and you lied. The defendant claiming consensual sex is a cliché. The change of pace is the best pitch in baseball.
I turned around. You were a master at it, Jimmy.
Talk to Emmeline.
Adios. Next time come back with your attorney. He stood up. His lips were gray. A strand of his hair hung over one eye.
You ever do something really bad? Something you can't get rid of? It messes up your thinking.
What are you talking about? I asked.
Hell if I know. Sometimes I think life is a pile of shit. Sometimes I feel like putting my grits on the ceiling.
Bad way to think.
I try to be the best guy I can. Most people don't believe that. Do you sleep through the night?
I killed people I had nothing against, Jimmy. That one doesn't go away.
Join the fucking club, he said.
He went out the door and didn't bother to close it. I looked at the photos of the hit and run on I-10. The homeless man who was killed was run over by not one but two cars, neither of which slowed down as they ground his body into the asphalt. Who were the drivers? Perhaps someone I'd meet on the street or see in church or watch sacking my groceries and never have a clue.
Chapter 11. My home group of Alcoholics Anonymous met in a small frame house on Center Street right across from Old New Iberia High. Most of the regulars were provincial and decent and middle-income people who simply wanted to live better lives, free of alcohol and alcoholism. Their histories were seldom dramatic. Few had been arrested for driving while intoxicated or causing a disturbance in public. Sometimes their sensibilities were tender. At the meeting, I owned up to slipping, or what we call going out. The room was dimly lit, the street empty of traffic, a freight train creaking slowly through town on Railroad Avenue. As I told the group how I had found the pirogue wedged against the dock at the foot of my property, and how I had drifted up the bayou and under the drawbridge to the bar and grill, I felt the oxygen leave the room. I had years of sobriety. I went regularly to meetings and worked the steps and sponsored other alcoholics, and yet I'd chosen to get drunk again and destroy not only my own life, but also the faith and trust of my fellows. Previously, I had told Alifair that I'd gone out because I'd wanted to. It wasn't quite that simple. I've always believed that alcoholism and depression are first cousins. This isn't an excuse, it's part of the menu. No one who has not experienced clinical or agitated depression coupled with psychoneurotic anxiety can appreciate a syndrome that, in an earlier time, was treated with a lobotomy. It's a motherfucker, no matter what you call it or how you cut it. There's blood in your sweat. Your head feels like a basketball wrapped with barbed wire. You'd eat a razor blade for a half cup of Jack or a handful of Reds or a touch of China White. There's another alternative. The big exit, with both barrels propped under the chin the way Hemingway did it. For me, the presences that the early Celts tried to keep inside the trunks of trees by knocking on wood always came out in the evenings, particularly in spring and summer, when the crepe myrtle and the pale green of a weeping willow seemed at odds with each other. In the croaking of the frogs, the dying of the light, the tide rising along the banks of the Teche, I felt a sensation like spiritual malaria imprisoning my soul. In an instant, the sky would turn to carbon. I think that's why I sometimes went out to Spanish Lake at sunset. I would see the boys, in butternut, sloshing through the flooded stands of cypress and willows, and somehow their loss became mine, allowing me to join the dead and escape the spiritual death I couldn't describe to others. I didn't try to explain these things to my friends at the Solomon House meeting in New Iberia, Louisiana. As I spoke, their eyes were downcast, their hands folded in their laps. Their embarrassment and pain were palpable. I did not tell them of the blackout because I had burdened them enough. After the meeting, they shook hands with me and patted me on the back. I didn't deserve to be in their presence, or at least that was how I felt. I also wondered what they would think if I told them they may have been sitting next to a murderer. On Saturday morning, I walked down to our old redwood picnic table by the bayou where Alifair was typing on her laptop. The trees were quaking with hundreds of robins, and a blue heron was standing in the shallows, pecking at its feathers. I hadn't intended to disturb Alifair, but she heard my footsteps in the leaves.
Hi, Dave. Just the man I want to see. I started a treatment for a screenplay.
Really?
Levon Broussard wrote a historical novel about his ancestor, a Confederate soldier who taught a slave girl how to read. It's probably one of his best books, but no one pays it much attention. I knew nothing of screenplays and had not read Levon's book about his ancestor.
Sounds like an interesting story.
It would make a great independent film.
So what's the problem?
I didn't ask permission.
Do high school kids have to ask an author's permission to write a book report about the author's work?
It isn't a legal problem unless I go to a producer or director with it or pretend that I represent Levon. I just thought he might be touchy.
Just tell him what you're doing. If he doesn't like it, put the project aside.
You don't think he'd mind?
He's an admirer of your work. He'll probably be happy.
How are you feeling?
She said.
Fine.
She searched my face.
No, you're not. You didn't sleep.
I've had worse problems.
You didn't kill that fella, Dave.
How can you be sure?
Because I know you.
Your war has always been with yourself, not others. I'm going to find out who's behind this.
Bad idea. And lay off the analysis, will you?
There are people who hate you and will do whatever they can to destroy you. It's foolish to pretend otherwise.
I don't know how my fingerprints got on D'Arteza's window glass.
Outside of the crime scene, I'd never seen his truck except at his house. I didn't touch it. I don't care if your prints were on it or not, she said. You didn't kill him. You get those thoughts out of your head. She stared at me boldly, as though words and righteous anger could change reality. That same morning, Cleet put down the top on his caddy, placed his saltwater rod and reel and an icebox load of beer and food into the back seat, and headed for the Gulf by way of Jennings and the trailer home of Kevin Penny. The shed that housed Penny's dirt bike was scorched by the fire I had set. The curtains were closed on the trailer's windows. There was no sound or movement inside. Cleet got out of the car and picked up several pieces of gravel and pinged them one at a time against the trailer. Penny opened the door in his pajamas, his eyes rheumy, his face unshaved. There was a knot above one eye and an angular orange and purple bruise across his face where I'd caught him with the pool cue.
What do you think you're doing, asshole?
I want to go fishing, Cleet replied.
Are you off your nut?
Have a beer. Penny stepped out on the stoop looking both ways. He was barefoot. A young woman hovered in the shadows behind him, peeking over his shoulder.
Where's your friend? He asked.
Which friend?
The one who attacked me with a pool cue?
I don't know anything about that, Cleet said. Kev, did I ever jam you?
Penny seemed to consider.
No. What about it?
I need your help. I'm being honest here.
I got company right now.
I can see that. She'll understand, right, lady? Can I borrow Kevin for a couple of minutes?
You finally fry your mush, Penny said.
You got around in Miami. You knew everybody in the life.
That was then.
You know who my daughter is?
No, I don't know who your daughter is. I don't give a shit either.
Her name is Gretchen Horowitz.
The fuck?
That's straight up. She's in Syria making a documentary about the refugees.
The Gretchen Horowitz I knew blew heads for the greaseballs.
Nobody's perfect.
Penny pushed the woman back inside and closed the door behind him.
What's the angle?
No angle. Your son is going to be with you shortly. We come from the same background, Kev. People knocked us around. When we grow older, we want to get even. Then we see somebody who reminds us of ourselves, and we get mad at them because we think they caused the injuries we had to suffer.
Penny stepped closer to Cleet, his nostrils flaring. His eyes were red-rimmed and seemed receded beyond the sockets as though he lived inside a husk.
You think I'm gonna welcome my kid home by beating him up?
You hurt him pretty bad before. Don't tell me you didn't.
I've been to anger management class.
That's like managing bone cancer. The people who peddle that stuff are douchebags. It's like listening to Pee-wee Herman talk about weightlifting.
This from you? Penny said.
Yeah, because I'm the dumb asshole who messed up his daughter and made an assassin out of her. I owe her a debt. That's why I'm trying to tell you. Get on the square and do right by your kid.
I'm going to take him to Disney World and Six Flags. I've got a job driving over the road. Maybe I'll take him on the road with me.
What about his schooling? Cleet thought. What about the loss of friends his own age? What about the fear that probably lived in him every mile on the road? But Cleet knew the situation was hopeless. The boy's fate was probably sealed. The blows to the face and head and back would start a short while after the boy came home.
Who's the woman in the trailer? Cleet said.
Miss Prime Cut. You want sloppy seconds, she wouldn't mind.
Penny wasn't being sardonic or ironic. He was serious. Cleet felt a rubber band pop behind his eyes. I don't think we're communicating. My vocabulary isn't up to the job sometimes. Where did you grow up? Where'd you go to school?
Yonkers in the South Bronx. Why?
What did your father do?
He was a baker. He made bread. My mother was a seamstress.
What?
You think my parents were trash?
No, I don't think that, Cleet said.
So what is this about? We're doing family counseling here? If so, mission accomplished.
Cleet pointed at a thicket of persimmon trees on the bank of a coulee that meandered into a dry rice field. The decomposed body of a black girl was found in there, one of the Jeff Davis Eight.
I wasn't living around here when it happened.
I think you were, Kev. I dream about those girls.
My son and I will bring you a souvenir from Six Flags, Penny said. Don't be mixing in my family life no more, Purcell. It can bounce back on the wrong people. Like you say, maybe I'll lose it again. Then you'd really have some thumbtacks in your head, wouldn't you?
Penny went back into the trailer. The young woman stared at Cleet like a drowning woman watching a lifeboat paddle away. Penny slammed the door. I hated the thought of interviewing Rowena Broussard. Her story and behavior were of a kind no ambitious prosecutor wants to touch. The particulars that would come out in the trial were a defense attorney's delight. I knew defense and liability lawyers who would drink out of a spittoon. They would be lining up at Jimmy Nightingale's door. I made an appointment Sunday afternoon at the Broussard home. Normally I tried to avoid working on the weekends, but I suspected Levon and Rowena already considered me unfocused and preoccupied since, like most civilians, they had no idea how many open cases a detective has on his desk at any given moment. I parked my truck in front of their home on Lauraville Road. The yard had just been cut, the oak leaves ground into tiny gold and red and brown pieces on top of the grass. The hydrangeas were blooming in the shade, the bougainvillea blood red on the trellises, the posts on the wide steel-gray gallery wrapped with Mardi Gras beads. Rowena answered the door. She was wearing huaraches and faded jeans low on her hips and a workout halter and a bandana twisted around her brow. Her forearms and the backs of her hands were flecked with paint. She didn't speak, at least not to me.
"He's here, Levon,"
she shouted over her shoulder.
"May I come in, please?" I said.
"Come in." "Thank you." I stepped inside. "I need to apprise you of your rights about a couple of things, Miss Rowena."
"Where do you want to do it?"
"Do what?" I said.
"Talk to me, or whatever."
"Wherever you like," I said. "You can have a lawyer or a female officer present. Any time you feel uncomfortable, we can take a break or simply discontinue the discussion. Our intention is to give the prosecutor's office the best information available." I thought I had been as accommodating as I could. Perhaps I wished she would not cooperate and allow me to drop the investigation. I didn't think I had ever seen a woman look more strangely at the world. She made me think of a thick-bodied, frightened bird trapped in a small cage.
Levon wants to be with us, she said. I'd prefer you and I talk first.
Go tell him that. He's at the end of the hall.
Didn't you just call him? I asked.
Watch the steps.
The center of the house was raised on pilings, the ornate baths and rooms with tester beds and Levon's office on a lower level. The hallway was long and lined with bookshelves and glass cases containing antique firearms. The woodwork in all the rooms was done with restored century-old cypress and radiated a soft, polished glow like browned butter. Levon's office was enormous and filled with light from the floor-to-ceiling windows. Two big fans circulated slowly on the ceiling. There were bamboo mats on the carpet that creaked dryly under my shoes. Outside, windmill palms and banana fronds and chest-high philodendron were threaded with moisture. I felt I had walked into a 1940s Sidney Greenstreet film. Levon was bent over the keyboard on his desk, which ran the entire length of one wall with a crucifix at either end. The Civil War sword that had belonged to his great-grandfather lay next to his computer. He saved the material he was typing and turned around.
Sorry to keep you waiting. If I stop in the middle of a paragraph, I can't put it together again.
He looked at the paragraph again. I had to wonder about his priorities.
Miss Rowena said you'd like to sit down with us. I'm afraid that's not the way we need to proceed.
Why not?
It's embarrassing for the victim. The victim is inclined to hide information. Third parties start interjecting themselves into the issue.
The issue? What kind of talk is that?
The kind I use when I speak to an intelligent man whom I'm treating as such.
The skin at the corners of his eyes crinkled. No matter how old Levon grew, he always looked young. He was also an innocent, even though he had worked for Amnesty International and had been jailed in Cuba and Guatemala. But I use the term an innocent in a different fashion. Like George Orwell, he believed the human spirit was unconquerable. He also subscribed to Orwell's belief that people are always better than we think they are. But sometimes his idealism and innocence led him into arrogance and elitism.
Take it easy with her, will you? He said. She had a hard go of it last night. Nightmares and such. A black hand coming through a window.
A what?
Nothing. She has bad dreams, Dave. What the hell do you expect?
I'll let you know when we're finished, I replied. He looked back at the page on his monitor, his attention somewhere else. I returned to the living room. Rowena was sitting in front of a giant brick fireplace and chimney, staring at the ashes caked on the andirons.
You'll have to excuse the way I look. I was painting. Can we go up to my studio?
I followed her upstairs to a spacious room with huge windows that looked down on the bayou and on live oaks that were so huge and thickly leafed that you felt you could walk across their tops. The sun's reflection on the water was like light wobbling in a rain barrel. She sat down at a card table and wiped at her nose and raised her eyes.
So ask me.
I sat down across from her. You drank about 4 Manhattans before you left the lounge, I said.
I had a couple of drinks earlier, too, before I went to the supermarket.
Did you fall down outside the lounge?
I don't remember.
I wondered if you hurt yourself.
Who said I fell down?
This isn't a time to hold back, Miss Rowena. The prosecutor is your ally. Don't let him go into court with incomplete information.
Jimmy Nightingale? Told you I fell down. You're saying that's how I got the marks on my body?
It's the question others will ask.
Nightingale put those marks on me, she said. He's salting the mine shaft, isn't he? What a piece of shit.
Let me be straight up with you. The defense attorney will probably be a woman. Gender buys jury votes from the jump. She'll say you didn't call 911.
You accepted a ride back to your car from the man you claim assaulted you. You didn't go to the hospital. You didn't have a rape kit done. And you showered, taking DNA possibilities off the table.
I told Levon.
Told him what? I asked.
I told him you'd side with that bloody sod whom people around here think so highly of.
That isn't how we work, Miss Rowena.
Stop calling me Miss. I don't like your plantation culture. If your ancestors had their way, we'd all be picking their cotton.
My ancestors were already picking it. What happened on the boat, Rowena?
You didn't hear enough on that video? You know what it's like to be filmed while you describe how someone ran his tongue all over you?
Tell me again.
He shoved me on the bunk. I tried to get up. I was stone drunk and couldn't defend myself. I felt his knees come down on me. He ripped off my panties. Then he did all the things I described on that fucking tape.
Her eyes were misting. The blood had drained from her cheeks into her throat. You said you felt his knees on you. That's a funny way to put it. I couldn't see. The pillowcase was on my head. He was crushing me alive. His mouth was all over me. I can't keep it straight.
Take your time.
I don't want to. I've said it over and over.
The defense will twist your words. They'll make you contradict yourself. They'll make issues out of minuscule details that have no bearing on anything. They'll create a scenario that has nothing to do with reality, thereby forcing the prosecution to prove that the scenario did not happen. The prosecution will have to prove a negative, which they can't do, hence creating reasonable doubt.
She blew her nose into a Kleenex. Nightingale said he tried to give you coffee, I said. When was that?
Coffee? He's a gentleman, is he? There was no coffee. There was only his penis, his tongue. Is that a sharp enough image for you?
I'm sorry about this, Miss Rowena. I lost my wife Annie to some killers who used shotguns on her in our bed. I've never gotten over it. I never will.
Her face seemed to freeze, as though she could not assimilate what I had said. I closed my notepad.
I appreciate your help today.
She didn't answer. She gazed out the window at the live oaks, the wind channeling through the new leaves, the dead ones tumbling on the bayou's surface.
Miss Broussard, are you okay? I said.
Her teeth were showing when she looked in my direction. But I couldn't be sure she saw me. I walked down the stairs and out of the house, closing the door softly behind me. I was old enough to know that insanity comes in many forms, some benign, some viral and capable of spreading across continents. But I believed I had just looked into the eyes of someone who was genuinely mad and probably not diagnosable, the kind of idealist who sets sail on the Pequod and declares war against the universe.
Chapter 12. When I got home, there were two messages on the machine from Babette Lachollet. I played the first one.
Mr. Dave, I got to talk with you. Call me back.
She didn't leave her number. I copied it from the caller ID. The second message was recorded 45 minutes later.
Mr. Dave, where you at? I think maybe I seen that guy last night. Please call me. Don't come to the bar and grill, no. My boss seen us talking and asked if I was in trouble. I can't lose my job.
I called her number and went immediately to voicemail. I tried again that evening with the same result. Cleet Purcell returned from 2 days of fishing, sunburned and flecked with fish blood and smelling of beer and sunblock and weed. He told me about his conversation with Kevin Penny. You think he's going to treat his boy all right? I said.
Probably not. It was like having a conversation with a septic tank.
You did your best.
There's only one solution for a guy like Penny.
I saw the look in his eyes.
negative on that, Cletus.
If he hurts that boy, I'm going to bust a cap on him. And stack his time.
How smart is that?
If either one of us was smart, we wouldn't be who we are. Maybe we'd be wise guys or stockbrokers. You gotta be careful what you wish for.
I had learned long ago to stay out of Cleet's head. If you let him alone, his moods usually passed. If they didn't, you got out of his way. He showered and put on fresh clothes at his motor court, and he and Alifair and I went to a movie. In the morning, I called Babette again. There was no answer. I gave up and this time left no message. Monday night, just after I had drifted off to sleep, the phone rang in the kitchen. I looked at the caller ID and picked it up in the dark. The moon was up, and a light rain was clicking on the roof and the trees.
Babette?
I'm sorry I ain't got back to you, she said. I moved my little girl to my mama's house in Brobridge.
Has somebody bothered you?
No, sir, but like I said on the machine, I think I seen the man again. The one who was talking to Mr. Spade.
Where?
At the Walmart. He didn't have a basket or nothing. He was maybe 30 feet away looking at me. He said, "Hi, you pretty thing. Come have a hot dog."
You sure it was the same man?
He looked a little different, but I'm pretty sure it was the man in the picture you showed me. The one who was outside the bar and grill.
He was different how? I asked.
Like he'd been in a fight.
Say that again.
His face was swole up. I called to tell you everything is all right and you don't need to worry no more. I got a hold of Mr. Spade.
Back up, Babette.
He ain't in the phone book, but a waitress I know had his number. So I told him about me talking to you and me seeing the guy again and how I don't want no trouble or to be saying anything bad about nobody.
I could feel the floor shifting under my feet.
Listen to me, Babette. Don't talk any more with Spade LaBiche. Stay away from him. He's not a good guy. I ain't supposed to talk to the police?
The man with the swollen face is a dangerous and violent career criminal. I don't know why he was with LaBiche, but I'm going to find out. What happened after you saw the man at Walmart?
Nothing. He just walked away.
What did LaBiche tell you?
He said not to worry. He said the guy was just asking him directions and he didn't know nothing about him. That ain't true?
It could be, I said.
It could be? Oh, Mr. Dave, what I'm going to do?
If you feel threatened, you can stay with my daughter and me.
That don't sound right. I can't live off other people.
I didn't know what to say. Who is usually the victim of a criminal? The most innocent of the innocent, and usually those who can least afford the attrition.
Are you there, Mr. Dave?
I'm going to talk to my friend Cleet Purcell. He's a private investigator. If you're with him, no one will ever hurt you. Give me your address. I went into LaBiche's office the next morning. How you doing, Spade? I said. He was drinking coffee from a white mug with Wonder Woman on it.
What's on your mind, Dave?
You know Babette Lachollet? She works at the bar and grill.
What about her?
She call you? He set the mug down.
Yeah, she did.
What do you want to know? She's a nice lady, don't you think?
Yeah, nice. Good-looking tits. Probably a sweet piece of barbecue. What else you want to know?
Why don't you show some respect?
I don't know what it is with you, Robichaud. You got a 2x4 with nails in it shoved up your ass every time I see you.
She saw you with a guy who sounds a lot like Kevin Penny. She doesn't know Penny. She has no connection with Penny. She didn't dime you about Penny. She simply described a man who looks like him. You were talking to him in the parking lot, outside the bar and grill where she works. What about it? Is Penny a confidential informant?
Number one, I never heard of this guy. Number two, if it was my snitch, I wouldn't meet him in a public place.
I'm glad you've cleared all that up, Spade. I heard you were undercover in Liberty City. How'd you get along with the Jamaicans?
Fine. They love the color green.
You ever see their transporters land in the Glades? A few times. Did you know the guys transporting coke on I-10? Most of them were blacks the Colombians used like Kleenex. They sure did a number on us. In 3 years, this whole area was full of dope. New Orleans became the murder capital of America. What's your point? I was just thinking about the systemic nature of the problem. It's like a virus. Those women who were killed in Jeff Parrish all had some relationship to the drug culture. The sales of five and dime stuff, all those lives were snuffed out for chump change. He toasted me with his cup before he drank. His fingers spread across Wonder Woman's patriotically dressed body. Close the door on your way out, will you? Be seeing you later, you lying motherfucker, I thought. But Labiche had little to do with the origins of my anger. Maybe he was on a pad, maybe not. I suspected he was a sociopath. Every organization or institution has sociopaths. The objective is always power. People like Labiche function because they're useful idiots. Prostitution and drug trafficking cannot exist in a community without sanction. Vice is symbiotic and, like a leech, must attach itself to a cooperative host. That's not hard to do. Once it's established, digging it out of the tissue takes years, maybe generations. The majority of victims are people no one cares about. Even though the street sales seem nickel and dime in nature, the aggregate can be enormous. The coke is stepped on half a dozen times before it reaches the projects. The skag might have roach powder in it. The speed comes out of labs at Motel 6. But the number of addicts always grows. It never declines. The health and psychiatric problems of the afflicted are pushed off on social services. The big bonus for the dealers is the female trade. They're compliant and easily managed. They provide freebies for corrupt cops. They're never more than one day away. Since Prohibition, vice on America's southern rim has been run by individuals and families in Tampa, Miami, New Orleans, and Galveston. When Huey Long gave the state of Louisiana to Frank Costello, slot and racehorse machines appeared in every hotel lobby, drugstore, and saloon in the state, followed by an invasion of pimps, hookers, and even commercial fishers. They worked for the mob in New Orleans and drained the lakes of crappie and sold them by the hundreds of thousands in Chicago. The system was like a pyramid. Everything at the bottom contributed to the top of the structure. In the life, it's called piecing off the action. A working girl who didn't understand that could get a cup full of acid in the face. I knew a black girl who was soaked with gasoline by two pimps and set on fire. The minions at the bottom of the organization are myriad and need lead shoes on a windy day. But there is always one person at the top and only one. In this case, the head guy was a steaming pile of gorilla shit known as Tony Nineball. All the elements in this story started with Fat Tony and the Civil War sword he planned to give to Levon Broussard, probably to involve Levon in one of Tony's movie productions. I told Helen I was checking out a cruiser and also where I was going with it. "What for?" she said, hardly able to conceal the ennui in her voice. "I think the deaths of the Jeff Davis Eight are indirectly on Nemo. I think the dope in Iberia perishes, too." "What you're really saying is somehow he's connected to the murder of T.J. Tartez. That's what you want to believe, isn't it? If you bruise Tony's ego, he never forgets." "Do what you need to," she said. "Watch your ass. Tony Nemo is a cruel man." "Does Spade Labiche have any reason for being around Kevin Penny?" "Not to my knowledge. You know something I don't?" I told her how Babette Lachollet had tried to return Labiche's lighter to him in the parking lot outside the bar and grill and had seen Penny talking with Labiche. "Did you bring this up with Labiche?" Helen said. "He denies knowing Penny or having any connection with him." "Did you tell him the barmaid informed on him?"
She had already called Labiche. She knows him from the bar and grill. I was trying to put out the fire and indicate to Labiche that the girl wasn't conspiring against him.
Take a breath.
It's frustrating, Helen. This guy's a son of a bitch, and you're pretending he's not.
I'll have a talk with him.
She got up from her desk and bit a hangnail, avoiding my eyes.
I'm worried about where the D'Arthez investigation is going. Your prints were on the broken window glass. How do you explain that?
I can't. She cleared her throat.
This is eating a hole in my stomach.
Then turn everything over to the prosecutor's office. I'll go on leave without pay or resign. She looked sideways at me, her face so hot it was almost glowing.
The case isn't prosecutable, not as it stands. A defense attorney would keep you off the stand and present a dozen ways the prints could have gotten on the glass. That makes me glad. It also puts me in conflict with myself. You're not the only person twisting in the wind, Pops.
I'm sorry you're caught in this. There may be another explanation about the prints, she said. Latents can be transferred. A microscopic examination can detect a forgery, but not always.
Labiche is manufacturing evidence? He's a mixed bag, she replied.
He's too nice around me, always with a grin.
I'd better get going. I'll be back this afternoon.
Keep Cleet out of this. No more Wild West antics at the OK Corral.
You have to admit, Doc and Wyatt had clarity of line.
White man who think with forked brain, not speak anymore. White man keep nose clean and not smart off unless white man won't slap upside head. White man, now get his ass out of my office.
She wiggled her fingers at me.
I hadn't thought about the possibilities with Cleet. After I signed out the cruiser, I stopped in the shade by the grotto and called his office on my cell.
Want to take a ride to the Big Sleazy?
What for?
To share a few oysters with Tony Squid.
I'll be out front.
2 minutes later, I pulled to the curb in front of his office. He was wearing his powder blue sport coat and pork pie hat and freshly ironed gray slacks and tasseled loafers shined as bright as mirrors. His eyes were clear, his face ruddy, his youthfulness temporarily restored, as always when he went 24 hours without booze.
"Let's rock," he said.
When he pulled open the door, his coat was heavier on one side than the other.
"What's in your pocket?" I asked.
"Lint," he replied. Every weekday at noon, Tony could be found at one of two oyster bars in the quarter, primarily because both had accommodations that could seat a gargantuan blob who had to spread his cheeks across a padded bench or two chairs pushed together. The restaurant also had to accommodate his oxygen cylinder, and sometimes a nurse and a retinue of hangers-on, and of course, his bodyguards, Maximo Sosa and Juju Ladrine. Juju was half coon-ass and half Sicilian, and could do squats with a 500-pound bar across his shoulders. He wore blue suits and ties and starched white shirts regardless of the heat, and in public always seemed embarrassed and popping with sweat and about to burst out of his clothes. Maximo was another matter. He had a 22-inch waist and the diminutive features of a child. He had been a jockey in Cuba. He wore a flat-topped gray knit cap with a bill, and unironed slacks that flapped like rags, and a suit coat buttoned tight at the waist and flared on the hips. He took orders from Tony as if there were no moral distinction between chauffeuring a limo and sticking an ice pick into one of Tony's enemies. I parked the cruiser in a garage on Royal, and Cleet and I walked to the oyster bar and went inside. It was 12:05 p.m. Tony was sitting at a long table in a back corner, the checkered tablecloth set with a pitcher of sangria and baskets of sourdough bread. Maximo and Juju were not Tony's only companions. The man seated immediately next to him was famous for all the wrong reasons.
plastic surgery had transformed him from a homely Ichabod Crane born in the Midwest to a regal and tragic Jeff